Our subject for this evening is the Jew in prophecy. There's no more perplexing problem facing those in places of responsibility in affairs of state than the problem of what to do about the nation Israel. If one could settle the Arab-Israeli dispute, his wisdom would be recognized as the wisdom of Solomon, and he would be considered a diplomat without an equal in the history of the world. The eyes of the world focus on the Near East. If, as is true, Palestine be the center of the world stage, then surely Israel, the chosen people, is the central figure in the coming end time drama. This is confirmed by the fact that according to the sure word of prophecy, the consummation of the age is actually the day of Jacob's trouble. Consequently, of all the multiplied indications heralding the fast approaching consummation of the age, it is our firm conviction that Israel is the key sign, sort of she, God's victory, definitely begin to bud, showing signs of reviving as a nation in her land, then may we indeed know that he is near, even at the door. For upward of 4,000 years, amid all civilizations and countries, and under all conditions of government, there has existed a distinct people with laws, habits, and customs distinctly their own. The history of the Jew is without parallel in human history. Though oppressed, downtrodden, carried captive to other lands, scattered among nations, they have risen from the ashes of their dispersions and appear now upon the page of history like never before. No nation has ever had such manifest and visible tokens of the divine presence. For them, the Red Sea was driven back and the Jordan parted. Fed miraculously in the wilderness, divinely sheltered and guided by the pillar of cloud and fire. No nation has given the world such great men as Abraham, Moses, Joseph, Daniel, or David. No nation has produced such prophets as Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and no nation has produced anyone like that man above all men, the man of Galilee. When Frederick the Great asked the preacher of the court for unanswerable proof in one word of the inspiration of the Bible, he replied, "The Jew, your majesty, for you see the emblem of the Jewish race is a bush burning and unconsumed." How are we to account for this wonderful preservation? First of all, a Jewish race was raised up to reaffirm and teach that there is but one God. Secondly, the Jewish race was raised up to be the writers, preservers, and transmitters of the Holy Scriptures. To them were committed the oracles of God. Paul, writing to the Roman church in chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, tells us that every page and book in the Bible were written by Jews. Thirdly, the Jewish race was raised up that God, through them, might give the world a Savior. Who was Jesus? A Jew. And how carefully his genealogy has been preserved in the Scriptures from Adam to his birth in Bethlehem. Fourthly, the Jewish race was raised up that they might save the world from moral decomposition. Salvation is of the Jews, John said in the Gospel of John chapter 4 and verse 22. Ye are the salt of the earth. The Jewish race were to be the means of preventing the moral putrefaction of the world. If they became extinct, God would destroy the world. And the salvation of the nations, morally and physically, and the preservation of the human race on the earth depends on the preservation and continuance of the Jews as a race. And in our discourse of the Jew in prophecy, We want to deal with the problem in the light of Scripture, touching on three important considerations: Israel in the past, Israel in the present, and Israel in the future. From the time of creation to the call of Abraham, God dealt with all people alike, recognizing no national distinctions or privileges. All men were on the same level before him, and revelation was made by God to all men, irrespective of race or geographical location. After the flood, which wiped the human race from the face of the earth, with the exception of Noah and his family, God revealed himself to Noah, and through him the knowledge of God was spread abroad over the face of the newly inhabited and repopulated earth. Men, however, rebelled against the revelation which God gave them and raised up gods for themselves, repudiating the revelation that God had given. It was against this background of rejection that God chose Abraham, that through him he might raise up a new nation as a new vehicle through which the knowledge of himself might be made known to men. God did not choose one well acquainted with the revelation of God, nor one who worshipped Jehovah as a true God. God came to a very world-wise but God-rejecting city, Ur of Chaldees. He went into the home of an idolater, for Abraham's father, Terah, was an idolater until the day of his death. And God attracted Abram out from his idolatrous family, out of this idolatrous city, and separated him unto himself. When God called Abraham, he gave him a promise. This promise contained personal blessings, national blessings, and universal blessings. The words, "I will bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee," Genesis 12:3, contained personal blessings. "I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing." Genesis 12 and verse 2 contains national promises. "And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." Genesis 12 and verse 3 makes a promise that is universal in scope. After Abram received this promise from God, although he was still under the leadership and headship of his father Terah, he departed from Ur of the Chaldees and came to the northern border of the land of Palestine, which God was going to give him. Accompanying him was his wife Sarah, his father Terah, and his nephew Lot. Now, according to Genesis chapter 11, verses 31 and 32, God halted the procession at the border of the land of Canaan and did not let them in because God had told Abraham to get out from under the authority of his idolatrous father as well as from the place of residence. So Abraham stayed there outside the land of Palestine until his father died. For you see, The definition of the name Terah is delay. And because Abraham at this time disobeyed God's request to separate himself from his kindred and from his family, and had his father accompany him, then the promise of God was delayed for the period that Terah lived. And it was not until Terah died that God communed with Abraham again. But after Terah's death, Abraham started out on his journey again, departed from Haran, and came into the land of Palestine. And there the Lord appeared unto him again and said, "Unto thy seed will I give this land." This same promise, of course, of the possession of the land of Palestine was reiterated and reaffirmed many times in God's dealings with Abraham and his descendants. In the Old Testament times, there were three ways by which a covenant might be rendered secure. The word covenant simply means a contract or an agreement, a mutual agreement between two individuals. And in the Old Testament times, there were three ways by which any contract or any agreement might be rendered secure. First of all, there was a shoe contract or covenant. Secondly, there was a salt contract or covenant. And then thirdly, and this was a most binding, the blood covenant. The most common method of confirming any agreement was a shoe covenant, in which the two contracting parties would exchange sandals. Travelers could not journey over the hot sands without sandals, and thus they were exchanging that which was necessary to their movement from place to place. The exchanging of that which was necessary to their traveling signified the exchange of something of value. When Boaz was going to redeem Ruth, he removed his shoe before the judges and gave it to the one who had the first right to redeem Ruth. Boaz was entering into just such a shoe covenant. The second and more binding covenant was a salt covenant. Salt was vital to the sustaining of life, especially to those traveling in the deserts, more so than even a sandal. Each traveler carried a leather pouch of salt to meet his needs. When two would be bound together in a contract more securely than that offered by a shoe covenant, each would take a pinch of salt from the pouch of the other and place it in his own pouch. The pouch would then be shaken. The contract obligation founded on the salt covenant could be broken only when each received his own pinch of salt back again. Since this was impossible, the salt covenant was considered a most binding contract. The third covenant was a blood covenant. In this form of covenant, the contracting parties would agree on the terms of the covenant. After this, they would take an animal, slay it, divide the carcass down the backbone, and place the divided parts opposite each other on the ground so as to form a pathway between the pieces. The two would join hands, recite the terms of the contract, and walk together between the divided halves of the slain animal. It signified that they were bound in a contract until death, and if either violated the terms of the contract, his blood should be poured out as the blood of the animal had been poured out. Abram was called on by God to prepare the animal which would make a blood covenant possible. God, who had promised a land and a seed to Abram, was about to confirm the promise with a ritual of a blood covenant. Because of the large number of animals God required for this ritual, when one would have been sufficient, Abraham certainly would have the impression of great significance attached to what was transpiring. Abraham slew the heifer, the goat, the ram, and the birds, and laid their carcasses out on the ground, preparing to enter into this blood covenant concerning the land and the air about which he and God had been speaking. At this point in the ritual, God caused a deep sleep to fall on Abraham so that he could not participate in the ritual personally. In his sleep, Abraham saw a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between the two pieces. Genesis 15, verse 17. In the Old Testament, the burning lamp or the light signified the presence of the Shekinah glory of God. God himself, apart from Abraham's participation or promise, was binding himself by a blood covenant to fulfill that which he had promised to Abraham. The terms of the covenant were clearly stated. In the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, "Unto thy seed have I given this land," Genesis 15 and 18. The dimensions of the land are clearly stated, stretching from the Nile to the Euphrates and from the Persian Peninsula to Asia Minor. In no clearer way could God signify to Abraham and Abraham's descendants that Palestine was their God-given possession. However, when we turn to the present position of Israel, we find that the nation, though promised the land of Palestine, is not in real possession of it. Why? Some hold that the covenant made by God, which gave Israel the land of Palestine, was a conditional covenant and depended upon the obedience of Abraham's descendants for its fulfillment. It is contended that if Israel did not obey, God would forget his covenant and abrogate his promise. But while God did promise chastisement for disobedience, God nowhere indicated that his covenant could ever be set aside. In the first place, when he made this covenant with Abraham, he was not making a covenant with a Jew, because Abraham was not a Jew. There were no such people at this time on the face of the earth, and no such race as a Jewish race. Abraham was not a Jew, should never be considered as one. His genealogical background is that of a Shemite, for he is a descendant of one of the three sons of Noah by the name of Shem. His nationality is that of a Chaldean, and therefore, nationality-wise, Abraham was a Chaldean, and racial-wise, Abraham was a Shemite. In this connection, when we turn to chapter 28 and chapter 30 in the book of Deuteronomy, we find some very important things that outline God's dealings with Israel and explain Israel's present position. The children of Israel had been out of the land of Palestine for more than 400 years when Moses delivered a message in Deuteronomy chapter 28. The land itself was again in possession of Israel's enemies, who sought to bar her readmission to the land. The redeemed nation, delivered from Egypt under Moses, was approaching the land of milk and honey under Joshua, only to find it a land flowing with strong enemies. Moses' message was given to strengthen Joshua and the people as they faced the task of re-entrance into Palestine. Now, many questions had arisen in their minds. Do we still have any rights there? Does that land still belong to us? Do we have the right to occupy it? Or will God be with us? Has he forsaken us and forgotten his promise? Moses gave assurance that even 400 years' absence could not abrogate the promise of God. For in Deuteronomy chapter 28, and in the first 14 verses, blessing is promised for obedience to God. And in chapter 28, verses 15 through 47, cursing and judgment are promised for disobedience to God. Now, following this, Moses prophesied the future Assyrian and Babylonian captivities, and also the Roman captivity, as God's judgments for disobedience. The judgment of God would take the form of captivity and expulsion from the land of promise. For God said, "The Lord shall scatter thee among all people from the one end of the earth even unto the other." Now, why was this curse imposed upon the people of Israel? God had made a promise to Abraham. He bound that promise by the blood covenant, and that promise entailed a land and a seed. In time, the seed was born, and the land was offered as a possession to the seed of Abraham. As Moses and Joshua guided the people of Israel out of Egypt through the wilderness to the boundaries of the land of Canaan, and as they camped on the last outpost to the border of Canaan, by the name of Kadesh Barnea, the leadership of Israel, instructed and inspired by the Lord, chose 12 men, one out of every tribe, so that all 12 tribes would be represented. Men of valor, men that had proven themselves to be valiant in battle. And they were instructed to go into the land of Canaan and to scout out the land. and to come back with a report to the people. When these 12 men were sent in to spy out the land, they found the land to be rich and truly a land that flowed with milk and honey. However, while they were viewing the richness and the wealth of the land, they also saw several tribes that lived in the land of Canaan. There were the Canaanites, the Horites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Zorites, the Amalekites, the Anakims, and some of those that they saw in the land of Canaan were so huge in stature that to them they appeared as giants, and they felt like grasshoppers in the presence of these men of huge stature. Their hearts were disheartened by these giants that they saw in the land of Canaan. And they came back to the people, and they started out with a good report, a positive report about the physical aspect of the land. The land is rich and flowing with milk and honey. They even brought samples of the richness of the fruits of the land, figs and pomegranates, and a huge cluster of grapes that they picked from the valley of Eshcol, so huge that they had to tie it on a piece of wood, and two men had to carry that cluster of grapes between them. And the hearts of the people of Israel were so overwhelmed and so thrilled by this wonderful report that these spies brought about the wonders of this land and about the wealth of this land, and that they said, "Why don't we go and possess the land? For God has promised it to us." However, the spies were divided in their thinking as to whether they would be able to possess the land at this time or not. 10 of them said, "We cannot possess the land because there are giants in the land. And they are too strong for us, and we are not able to conquer them and possess the land." It was such a pity that these people had soon forgotten the wonderful miracles of God, their deliverance out of the land of Egypt, the parting of the waters of the Red Sea, the destruction of Pharaoh's army. When they were hungry in the wilderness, God miraculously fed them with manna from above. When they were thirsty, water came out of a rock to quench their thirst. At night time they were protected by a pillar of fire before them and behind them. In the daytime a cloud hovered above them, guiding them through the wilderness. The presence of Jehovah God went with them all the time. They were protected, they were made secure by the presence of God and by the power of God. However, when they saw these giants in the land of Canaan, these spies seemed to forget all about the miraculous God that brought them out of the land of Egypt, that had leveled all of the gods of Egypt and the might and the power of Egypt to the ground, and humbled them to the extent that they finally conceded that the God of Moses was greater than all of the gods of Egypt put together. They forgot all of these things, and all they could think about is that they were too small in comparison to the giants that they saw to fight them and to be able to possess the land. You see, God never meant for them to fight this battle. All that God wanted them to do is believe in Him and have faith in Him to go into the land of Canaan and claim it as their own, and He would fight their battles for them. 2 of the 12 spies, however, maintained their faith in God, and they began to talk to the people to try to convince them that God had promised them this land and he was going to help them possess it as far as the giants in that land were concerned and all of the rest of the tribes that they had seen. God had made them like bread in their hands, and they would be able to possess the land if they would just have faith in God. But as is always the case, the majority ruled at this time, even though the majority was wrong. The two spies, Joshua and Caleb, were overridden by the arguments of the 10 spies, and the people listened to the 10 spies rather than listen to Joshua and Caleb, and they rebelled about going to possess the land of Canaan. And as a result of that, God himself scattered these people from the one end of the earth even unto the other. And he placed a curse upon the people of Israel, and he placed a curse upon the land as well. And when these Jews received the judgment of God, it was so severe and it was so harsh that it entailed the following. From the age of 20 and up, every one of you will die here in the wilderness, and your bones will bleach in the wilderness. And everyone from the age of 20 and under will be dispersed and scattered to the four corners of the earth. Your fear will be so great that every time you hear the sound of a falling leaf, you will think that there's someone after you to kill you. And when night time comes, you will wish it was daytime. God placed a feeling of suspicion in the hearts and the minds of the dispersed of Judah and Israel, so that these people would suspect anyone that was not a Jew as being their enemy, and conceiving in their minds to do them harm. And so the dispersion took place following the death of Solomon, the third and the last king that the 12 tribes had. As soon as Solomon died, the kingdom was divided. Rehoboam, his son, retained possession of 2 of the tribes, Judah and Benjamin, and Jeroboam, a usurper, ruled over the 10 tribes, set up his capital in Samaria, and these 10 tribes became known as Israel, and the 2 tribes became known as Judah. In B.C. 721, the 10 tribes were carried captive by the Assyrians to the land of Assyria. In B.C. 606, 100 years following the captivity of the 10 tribes, the 2 tribes were carried captive to Babylon. Jerusalem was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. The furnishings of the temple were confiscated by the Babylonians and brought to the city of Babylon. And with the captivity of Judah and the destruction of Jerusalem began the long period which still continues in history, known as the times of the Gentiles. Now, I have traveled extensively, and everywhere I have been in this world, I made it a point to check and see if I could find Jewish people. And prior to the year 1950, every country I went to, I found Jewish people living there. They were not living in a state of contentment and peace and happiness, but they were living in a state of constant fear, in a state of constant provocation, in a state of constant harassment. I have been in practically all of the Middle East countries. I have visited countries like Egypt and Syria and Lebanon, Mesopotamia, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, some of the countries on the border of the continent of Africa. In every one of these countries that I visited, I found Jewish people there as a result of the dispersion and the scattering, living under miserable conditions, constantly harassed by the government and constantly harassed by the people, which were enemies to the Jews. It was not a strange thing at that time to walk through the streets of Cairo, Egypt, and come across a body lying on the sidewalk, shot to death, and discover that the man is a Jew. It was not strange to walk in the city of Damascus and all of a sudden see a building go up in flames, and when checked, to discover that the building was a store that belonged to a Jewish merchant had been set afire by the Syrians, enemies of the Jews. I lived in the city of Jerusalem for 19 years of my life, and during the conflict of 1948, I saw many times Jews shot to death by Arabs. Some of those Arabs were about 15 years old, some 13 years old. I stood on the sidewalk of a street in one of the communities of Jerusalem, looked across the street, and I saw a 13-year-old boy with a gun in his hand come behind a family of three, a Jewish family of three. I saw him take that pistol out of his pocket and aim it at the back of the head of the man and the woman and the little boy they had with them, and shoot all three of them to death. Nobody raised a hand of objection. Nobody went to check on them. They lay in their blood until some of their friends had nerve enough to come to carry those bodies away. And not only in the Middle East countries, but I was privileged to travel beyond the Middle East. I have been to the Orient. I have been to countries in Europe. I have been to other countries in Asia Minor. And practically every country I went to, I found Jewish people living there. When I was in serving in the armed forces, I was sent to Korea. One day while I was in the city of Seoul, I was visiting some of the stores there to see if I could find some souvenir items that I could bring back home. That is, if the Lord spared my life out of the Korean conflict. And I finally saw some things in a store window and walked in the store, but to my surprise, the proprietor was not present there to wait on me. And I knocked on a showcase in that store, and nobody came out to wait on me, and I thought that was strange. The street that I'd been walking on had shops on either side of it, and the merchants would be out there standing in front of their shops, and whenever they saw a GI walking by, they'd chase him for about a block and a half, trying to talk him into coming into their stores and shop at their stores. And here was a Korean store with no proprietor there showing himself to wait on a GI soldier. And so I knocked some more on the showcase, and no one came out to wait on me. I saw a curtain that seemed to hide an entrance to the back of the shop, so I went to the back there and moved the curtain back a little bit, and I looked in, and there in a very dimly lit narrow chamber, I saw what I thought a little Korean man sitting on a rocking chair with glasses on his eyes, a little black cap on his head, a goatee beard, and a book in his hand. And he was reading out of that book, rocking himself back and forth. I shook the curtain a little bit and rattled a little bit, trying to draw his attention to myself, but I was not successful. Finally, I walked over to his side and I placed my hand on his shoulder gently and tried to get him to notice me, but I was not successful even at that. Finally, I just happened to glance down at the book that he was reading, not trying to be nosy about what he was reading, but I just casually glanced down at the book. I thought to myself, my, this book must be a very interesting book for this gentleman to be so engrossed with it that he is not even concerned about a customer in his store. And when I looked down at the pages of the book that that man was reading from, I almost passed out. Since I can read the Hebrew language, I was looking at a book that was written in the Hebrew language, and it happened to be a copy of the Old Testament in the Hebrew language. And of all the places in the Bible to be reading from, this man was reading out of the book of Isaiah, and you probably guessed it, the 53rd chapter. Now, the 53rd chapter of Isaiah deals with the carnage of Christ, the death of Jesus Christ, his suffering. He was wounded for our transgressions, this man was reading. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. I became so excited, so galvanized with interest, got a hold of the shoulder of that old, what I thought, Korean man, and I really shook him. I wanted his attention now. Finally, and very casually, the man shut that book, put it down, he took his glasses off, and he put them away in his pocket, and he rubbed his eyes, and finally he looked up at me. And as I looked into his features with a question that was on my mind and already on my lips, I knew the answer before I asked it, but I asked it anyway. I said, "What in the world is it Korean doing here in the city of Seoul, reading out of the Torah and from the book of Isaiah, and especially chapter 53 of the book of Isaiah?" And he looked up at me very gently and very benevolently. He said, "Who said I was a Korean?" And sure enough, as I looked into the features of that elderly gentleman, I could see the features not of an Oriental, but that of a Semitic. And I felt like Philip the evangelist in the desert of Gaza, standing by the chariot of the eunuch, when I asked him this question, without even realizing I was asking it like Philip asked it. "Do you understand what you are reading?" And that little Jew looked up at me and he said, "Yes, I understand what I'm reading. And furthermore, I've got my store for sale. And the first one that comes to buy my store, regardless of the price they offer me, I am going to accept it and I'm going to sell out." And that didn't sound like a Jew that we know that is so wrapped up in making money. And he said, "When I sell my store, I'm going to pack up my little belongings and I'm going to go to the homeland. And there in my homeland, the land of Israel, I am going to wait for the return of my Messiah." And I said to him, I said, "Who is your Messiah?" And he looked up at me and he said, "You are a Gentile. And you ask me who my Messiah is?" I said, "Yes, I am a Gentile, and I'm asking you who your Messiah is." And he said, "My Messiah is the same one as your Jesus Christ." You talk about a thrill. I felt like shouting up and down that little chamber in the back of that store. For here was a little Jew, part of the scattering and the dispersion of the people of Israel, in a land that we did not know much about until the Korean conflict, in a little place here in the city of Seoul, believing that Jesus Christ was a true Messiah, his heart longing for the time when he could return to the homeland and there await the return of the Messiah. He said, "My forefathers made the mistake of thinking about Jesus Christ, our Messiah, as an imposter. But we're not going to make this mistake again. In fact," he told me, "that in the near future, a Sanhedrin is going to be formed, and they're going to hold court again and revise a trial of Jesus Christ and find out where they have erred in sentencing him to die the death of an imposter." And I looked at that man, I said, "We believe also that your Messiah is coming back. However, we believe that before he comes back to you, he is coming back to his church to take it unto himself and to receive it unto himself. And then he and the church together are going to come back to this earth to establish his reign on this earth and to restore unto you the kingdom of Israel. As for these Jews that were scattered among the nations of the world, they had to go through extreme times of suffering because it was meant for them to suffer because of their rebellion against God's promise and because of their rejection of that promise to possess the land of Canaan. God had to punish them for their spirit of rebellion. And therefore, every country that they were scattered to, from the destruction of Jerusalem to the 1900s, in the medieval period of persecution, Jews were struck by it. In 1492, the Jews were ordered out of Spain. They went to Portugal and were expelled from there also. Thousands were loaded on board vessels whose hulks were rotten, and large numbers perished at sea. In 1264, England celebrated Easter by putting 50,000 Jews to death. 1267, Germany wiped out 140 Jewish communities and roasted alive 100,000 Jews. A pope issued a decree that Jews should wear a badge of shame. From the 1300s to the 1400s, in Eastern Europe, the Jews suffered tremendously, and a record of tragedy in history was made as a result of their suffering. 1942 through 1944, Hitler and his Nazi cohorts liquidated 6 million Jews, the greatest mass murder of Jewish people in all history. And for the past 1700 years, the Jews have become known as the wandering Jews. However, in all of their times of persecution and their times of punishment, God never at any time disannulled the covenant that he had made with Abraham relative to his seed. In 1895, a young Jew by the name of Theodor Herzl, with the publishing of a book, issued a clarion call from a great Jew to his scattered kinsmen to get together. In 1897, The first Zionist Congress was formed and met in Switzerland. The object of their meeting? National restoration. Leaders of Jewry all over the world began to promote a return to the homeland. How to accomplish this was a big question. However, the new day dawned in the midst of World War I for the Jews. England, hard-pressed for a need of production of explosives on a much greater volume, turned to a young Jewish scientist by the name of Chaim Weizmann for help. He succeeded in the invention of TNT and contributed much in the victory of Britain in the war. A reward was offered this young man, and this led to an agreement between Chaim Weizmann and Britain in the issuance of the Balfour Paper issued by Lord Arthur Balfour, promising the Jews a homeland. This was a reward offered Chaim Weizmann by Lloyd George, then Prime Minister of Great Britain. 1917, Lord Allenby, a Christian general, led a British force into Palestine and to Jerusalem, thus capturing it from the Turks without a shot being fired. 1945, the United Nations replaced the League of Nations, assigning Britain to maintain law and order with no success in the land of Palestine. The British were hated by both Jews and Arabs. In the month of May, the 14th day of the month of May, in the year 1948, the United Nations partitioned the land after Britain announced their withdrawal from the responsibility carried under international mandate. A Jewish state was born. It was quickly recognized by the major countries of the world. 2,500,000 Jews returned to Palestine in less than 3 years from the date of the creation of Israel. They were added to the 20,000 that were already in the homeland. However, less than 5,000 Jews are believers in the return of the Messiah and in the prophecies of the Bible. By 1952, from 1948 to 1952, 87 countries had been completely evacuated of all Jewish people. And these important verses in Zechariah, chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, point out a very significant truth. Israel gathers itself together mostly in unbelief and continued rejection of Jesus as the Messiah before the end time tribulation. Which is to say that, although she is marvelously helped of the Lord in this partial and preliminary regathering, the regathering precedes her final and complete restoration to the Holy Land as a purged and regenerated nation at the return of the Messiah, whom she will then accept. Thus does Jacob unwittingly return to Palestine for the day of his trouble, the consummation of the age which is so significantly heralded by Israel's regathering. And we shall now briefly consider a threefold sign of the budding of this fig tree. First of all, there's a revival of the nation. The meaning here, of course, is not national revival in a political, in a spiritual sense, but rather in a political one. On this vital topic, there is no more important passage than Ezekiel chapter 37, which contains the prophet's unusual vision of the valley of dry bones. This is explained to be a picture of the chosen nation, dead as such, scattered among all the nations of the world upon her rejection and crucifixion of Messiah. In this dispersed condition, there seems to be little hope for national life again. But the Almighty One begins to act, and the dry bones do live.
Israel's restoration to life as a nation in her land is guaranteed. Further, let it be carefully noted that this marvelous prophecy in Ezekiel 37, just preceding the account in chapters 38 and 39 of the coming vicious attack of Armageddon on restored Israel by Russia and her horde during the end time period of Jacob. Now we raise a vital question, of course. Are there signs of the budding of the fig tree? The answer is obvious. While there were only 20,000 Jews in Palestine after World War II, there are today over 3 million Jews. And when in May 14, 1948, Israel was officially reborn as a nation, and this stupendous fact is alone sufficient to satisfy the honest seeker that the consummation of the age is very nigh. But when viewed in the light of the numerous other sure heralds of its nearness, the proof is overwhelming that the return of Christ must indeed be imminent, especially when it is remembered that in the case of the fig tree, there is only a brief time between the budding and the fruit. And of utmost significance to the born-again Christian is the promise of our Lord to come for us even before the end-time drama begins. There's also revival of the land, simultaneous with the revival of the chosen people politically as a nation in Palestine. God has promised to begin the restoration of her desolated land to its Eden-like state of beauty and fruitfulness. The people and the land are inseparable in God's program. When Israel was scattered among the nations of the world, Palestine was made a waste and desolate, a barren and desert land. But now Israel is back in the promised land, and, as he had promised, he has begun to make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. What a thrilling commentary do we have here on the sure word of prophecy. Not too many decades, a delegation was sent to Palestine to investigate its possibilities as a suitable homeland for scattered Israel. But they reported the land as being too desolate to take care of the people. Today it would be difficult, if not impossible, to find a more flourishing, fruitful, and fast-growing country than the Palestine of Israel. Hath he spoken, and will he not do it? Hath he promised to restore his people to their land, at the same time restore the land for his people, and thus before our very eyes, beholding a veritable miracle as a great creator opens up springs in the desert and makes a wilderness flourish and the desert to blossom like the rose? The fact that this restoration of the land is only partial and preliminary, its final and complete fruition coming at the return of Christ, in no wise minimizes the significance and import of the wonderful fulfillment of prophecy we are witnessing today.